Hello, Midi. Really nice to see you here again. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. I think it'll be great to learn more about you as, a product manager of Stripe, but also it'll be great if you can give us a bit of a background on yourself, your career, how you've ended up in Stripe. Maybe a bit about you being in the US for a long time. And yeah.
Absolutely. Let me just start at the very beginning. I was actually born to the US. My parents came, first my dad to New York, and then my mom and my dad came together and they moved to North Carolina. And then, here comes me and my brother. And instead of going back to Turkey like they always planned, we were kind of, in the US, in North Carolina, growing up in the thick of Americana. It was amazing. I loved being in both worlds. It has its challenges, obviously, but one of the best parts was just this real appreciation for how hard you have to work to make it, and just understanding what it takes to kind of chase a dream and then, be able to realize that dream like my parents were able to do. Which kind of lets us jump forward to kind of after college. Growing up in Raleigh, I was desperate to kind of make it to Silicon Valley. So, coming out of school, computer science, really wanted to go to Silicon Valley, lots of internships. Ended up at a company called TalkBox, where I was an engineer when I first started. And I really thought that becoming a product manager would mean that I failed as an engineer. I really didn't want, I think that, my parents set this expectation that, you go to school, you become an engineer, and that's like a path forward in life. And so I didn't actually see a path outside engineering as anything but failing. And I had a lot of really good mentors along the way, especially at TalkBox. One was the CEO, Ian Small, who kind of sat me down and he said, "Look, you're good at talking to customers. You're good at painting a picture of what we need to build. And you can build it, but there are people who will always be able to build it better than you. You should really focus on those first two pieces." And that was such a critical point for me where, Ian spent that time. Here he is, the CEO of a company, trying to raise money, trying to keep us afloat. And I'm, straight out of school, 23 years old, trying to figure out up or down. And, he sat me down and he said, "This is the best path forward." And, I really took that leap of faith with him. And it's done nothing but return many times over. And I was just really incredibly lucky to have him there in that moment to kind of talk me through that, and kind of give me what that path looked like and why it wasn't failing.
That's great. I'm curious about when you were in TalkBox building a career on product management. How was that back in the days? Because now it's one of, from a talent perspective, of course, I'm curious to learn how it felt during, back like 10 years ago. Now it's one of the most hot roles to have in a startup. Yeah.
No, absolutely. To date myself even more, it was, probably 15 years ago that I made this switch. And back then, right as kind of Facebook apps were emerging, the news feed was emerging, Zynga was a big name on the market, the skill that was product management was much more amorphous than it is today. The APM program had just started at Google. There were lots of tech companies who had product managers. But there weren't the resources, people like Lenny's podcast didn't exist. You didn't have lots of resources online. There weren't books on how to do product management interviews. So a lot of it, honestly, we were making up as we went along. A big part of the leadership we got was from people who had either been trained in or had access to consumer brands, right? So one of the first VPs of product who I worked for had actually worked at Colgate and had transferred a lot of those kind of consumer brand marketing skills over into technology, marketing, and product. The obsession with the customer was always a constant, I would say, throughout my career. But I think the artifacts that we created, the complexity of those artifacts, the way product management wove into day-to-day engineering operations, the way that we were able to kind of work with design, we were inventing a lot of that as we went along, and partly because it was a small company. TalkBox was only ever 35 people or so. But I think partly too, because product management was still something in tech that was still trying to define what it was.
Yeah. And you stayed there for a long time, 8 years, where you established that product management schooling. And after that, how exciting were you to, you know, to continue with product management? Then what were you looking forward to at those times? What were some hot career movements that you could have made within products that, you know, enabled you to take on other responsibilities, like managing a team and or moving to another industry within product management areas?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I got really lucky because my next stop was at a company called Hearsay Systems, where the person who ran product was a fellow named Mark Gilbert, and he had been taught product management at Microsoft. So I got to learn a ton from him about what it looked like at a big company, but apply those skills at, you know, a little bit more of a medium-sized business, right? So I didn't go to Microsoft per se. I didn't get the big company skills, but Mark really brought the intuition, the way to do customer development, how to avoid being an agency where big companies just ask you to build a thing and therefore you have to build it, how to weave customer feedback into a roadmap. For me, the kind of next couple steps were all about becoming better at that 0-to-1 skill of understanding that what the customer is asking for is not always what the customer needs, and then being able to extrapolate that into a vision and a direction for the engineering and designs teams. And at both kind of TalkBox and Hearsay, the piece for me that was the most exciting was not just getting my local team to rally behind a specific vision, but really being able to move a business in a certain direction as well. I think it's incorrect when people say PMs are their own CEOs, right? I think CEOs have lots of responsibilities that product managers never pick up. But I think product managers who act like they are running a business, who feel like they're responsible for the P&L, they're responsible for setting up their partners in marketing and sales for success, especially in B2B roles, that mentality and being able to refine and develop that mentality was my next really big step and something that really kind of helped me get to the next level.
Yeah, maybe continuing from there, I would really want to understand how you build teams. When we first met, we did talk about your career, you coming from a Turkish family and then born and raised in US. You built on a career in product management. But when I first looked at your LinkedIn profile, I saw at the About section, you had this story about building teams, building rocket ships, what you called actually. Can you elaborate more on that? Well, how do you describe rocket ships? Who do you think are eligible to stay in your ship? Who are the captains? Who are the crew? I was really interested in that story.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to kind of give everyone some context, you know, I've had kids most of my adult life. So one of these quiet nights where there's not crying and screaming and chaos, I decided to just kind of write a bit of a mission statement. And what I realized is the reason I love products, the reason I'm really kind of inspired to come in and build products every day is that opportunity with technology to build something that can fundamentally change people's lives, right? Fundamentally take them into a plane, to a planet where no one else can go. And as product managers, we build those rocket ships that people want to jump into to be able to get to that next level of experience, of life, of opportunity. That's kind of the story behind the rocket ship a paragraph that I wrote there, the little essay I wrote there, which is on my LinkedIn page. And for me, I got really lucky. When I first got into management, I had some people who took a leap of faith on me as a leader. And where I didn't have all the best management skills, they believed in the vision that I wanted to build at TalkBox and at Hearsay. And they were willing to go along on the ride of me becoming a better manager because the vision of what we were trying to accomplish was an outcome. It was a world that they wanted to be a part of building. And I think that's the key thing of the rocket ship is your team, your customers, even kind of your leadership, they have to believe in that place that you're taking them to. And so that ability to tell that story, the ability to carve that story and to convince people through data, through customer stories, through your own intuition, through the relationships that you build, that that place that you're trying to take them is a place where there's change, where there's a place where there's less cost, there's more opportunity, there's a way of doing things that's different than it was before, and that that way is better. That's really the kind of the first and most critical step, because if people don't believe in you, they're not going to join you on the journey. I think the next thing, though, and you made a really good point with your question of like, who's the captain, you know, who's on the crew, where are they? I think one of the key things I learned is that trying to always be the captain is quite dangerous. A big part of being able to build a team, a big part of being able to become a leader who builds rocket ships is understanding that at any given moment, it may not be your rocket ship to direct. That you have to be able to let other members of your team, other members of your business in the right moment take the helm. What today may be a product problem may tomorrow be a marketing problem. What today may be a product strategy problem may tomorrow be an execution problem. And making sure that the right person is the storyteller and the leader in that moment, I think is actually a really critical part of whether you're going to be successful or not.
Great. It really is, I think, the hardest part to become an inspirational leader, you know, to create a team that will follow you and believe in you and to motivate them towards the same goal and direction. What do you think are some critical points that you've done that were, you know, some very critical turning points in your career that made that shift, you becoming a leader and directing a team, yeah, in general?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny how these things tend to come from negative experiences or, you know, maybe like negative adjacent experiences. I had one moment really that kind of allowed me to kind of get to my next level, which was I kind of had this experience where I looked around and I realized that my manager was either actively micromanaging me or actively trying to manage me out. And it was a very bizarre experience because our numbers were great. Our customers were really happy. The NPS score was moving up. A lot of the things that I thought were the reason that we were successful, the reasons that I was successful, were up and to the right. And yet here I was failing in the eyes of my manager. And I couldn't really kind of put two and two together. And I've never been one who was comfortable or able to really kind of push on those types of conversations. But at one point, I just sat down with them and I said, look, obviously, this is happening. Obviously, like, you know, you're not happy. I'm not happy. What's going on and why? And it was really the first time that I was sat down and kind of given that kind of critical feedback in a way that allowed me to reflect on it, to absorb it. They gave me some fantastic books to read. One of them is What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And I forget the author, but it's an absolutely superb expose. They're a researcher at Dartmouth Business School. That's what I remember. And it really kind of helped me realize that just because you were successful as a ICPM, just because you found product market fit with one thing, you can't just replicate that playbook over and over again and assume it works at all levels of a career and all instances of a product. You have to be able to become the next stage. You have to be able to adapt to the skills you don't have yet. And both like coming out of that conversation, the humility of that moment, but also the opportunity to correct it and to be able to kind of grow with them and have them coach me on what that next level could be was really eye-opening for me. And it really helped me understand that if I wanted to be not just a PM, but a product lead, I really had to understand the difference between those two stages and actually invest the time and invest the kind of the learning pains and the failures that would come with learning those new set of skills. And that was really critical. Without that, I don't believe that, you know, I would be at Stripe. I don't believe that I would have the successes that I've been able to pick up since I had that role.
Great. Yeah, I do believe that those kind of experiences do teach you a lot. It's more of an iteration process where you need to get feedback.
Absolutely.
Have maybe discomforting, you know, experience, which would then lead on to a better one since you're on top of it and you learn other ways to deal with it. then maybe we can also talk about culture and how you think culture plays a role in the different companies that you've worked for. Mm-hmm. And maybe were there times where you also created your own culture language, which you think was helpful in building a team in Stripe now and moving forward?
No, absolutely. So very early on at TalkBox, there was a group of us who were individual contributors. And the shape of the office was such that the executive team sat next to the windows that were facing over King Street in San Francisco. And the rest of us were kind of on the inside of the building. And so I was always teasing the executive staff. I'd say, like, you guys are the windows. You guys get all the fancy offices. And we're just like the peons in the back. So we had this like Windows versus peon thing that was always a joke, but we always had a lot of fun with it. It allowed us to kind of create these moments of just like silliness, and it broke down some of the hierarchical tension that exists in any company. As we were continuing to build that team, at that point, we were only 12 people. As we got into the 20s and 30s, we would build, you know, run clubs or like, you know, dinner clubs or things of this nature. And we'd always have these competitions between the windows versus the P staff. It was always meant to be something fun. And I think we kept it light and we had a really good chance to just kind of laugh at ourselves about it. But I always remember that to this day, because it really taught me that if we can't kind of laugh at ourselves, if we can't be at work with people who we enjoy laughing with, you're just spending too much time at the office. You're spending too much time solving a problem. And it's just not worth doing if you're not doing it with people you enjoy being with. And I loved having that experience early in my career because it set a bar for me where if I could detect that a culture was not going to allow me to kind of have that freedom, to have that kind of energy, to be able to invest in my peers, but also in my leadership, that I knew it was going to be the wrong culture for me. And where I'm really lucky right now at Stripe, and I'm in the Stripe billing team, is we've actually been able to replicate a lot of that kind of teamwork, a lot of that ability to kind of laugh with each other and also get a lot of work done at the same time. And the fundamental difference between now and then is I'm in New York, my entire team is in San Francisco. So we've had to build those bridges in a relatively remote world. You know, I've only met my boss 3 times and I've been here almost 2 years in person. And so being able to kind of have that sense of trust, that sense of familiarity, but also that ability to kind of get to the whiteboard and get work done, I think has really been a critical part of how I try to build cultures, and also a key signal for me about whether I'm going to be successful in the culture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, we've experienced a lot during this pandemic period where you started remotely and you're in Stripe now. You just saw your manager 3 times. Yeah, we're all used to it now. We met each other through Zoom. Now we're doing this podcast. So,
exactly.
Yeah, it's exactly. So we're building communities through virtual ecosystems. And it definitely is, different. But at the same time, I guess it's much, much easier than I thought, let's say.
I'm surprised, too, you know, at how easy it is, because it's hard to have a casual conversation. Because you don't run into people, you know, at the kitchen. You don't run into people as they're coming into and out of the building. There are all these kind of physical moments that let you create camaraderie, that let you kind of build friendship. Mm-hmm. But I think one thing we've just adopted with our reality being remote is that you can create those moments on purpose, but still give yourself the space and give your teammates and your peers and your leadership the space for the conversation to be really casual. You know, I would say 1 out of every 6 one-on-ones that I do with my boss is incredibly casual. And, you know, maybe he's had a tough day, maybe I've had a tough day, and, you know, the status list really doesn't matter. So, you know, and he's Bulgarian, I'm Turkish. So we talk about feta cheese, we talk about the Black Sea, we talk about growing up in these places or seeing family in these places. And you can create those bridges, even though there's distance, as long as there's kind of an acceptance that it doesn't have to be work all the time. And I think that's a really important part of a remote just kind of remote team building is creating that space for casual and just for like that human element.
If we go back to product management, building a career in product management, can you elaborate more on how technical you need to be to become a product manager, and how in different industries, how different skill sets go with each other? Do you need to relearn stuff in, you know, in different industries, etc.?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think first of all, the myth of you have to have a computer science degree to be a product manager is absolutely a myth. Having said that, you need to be able to call out your engineering team or your design team on certain trade-offs. And to get there, you may need to be more comfortable with technology than, let's say, you know, you would be if you were a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. So there's some balance in between. Not everyone has to have been a software engineer who transitioned into product management. With if you can't look at a whiteboard or if you can't look at a schedule and call out that something should not take a week, or that, you know, spending a day on something is actually too little time, and that you want to explore more of the kind of technical trade-offs, you've got to be somewhere kind of in between like those two, where you are comfortable enough to have that conversation, even if you're not the one writing the React code or, you know, building the Kubernetes modules or things of that nature. And so my encouragement for most folks who aren't technical is really, you know, if you're at a company, you're not technical, you want to go into product management, the best way to do it, honestly, is dive into support tickets, understand what support tickets are driving the support team the craziest, and understand how you would fix those. And then go to the PM who owns that area and ask if you can build it. Because that's a really good way to kind of understand, can I understand the customer? Can I turn that into a plan? And can I work with the people whose area this is to get that plan executed? And if you find yourself going through a loop like that and you feel relatively successful, I think that's actually a really good indicator that you've got the bare bones kind of intuition and skills, and that you can develop the rest, right? You can develop the ability to write documents. You can develop the ability to do formal customer interviews, you know, write queries or work with a data science partner to get the queries for the data that you need. And I think that transitions well into the second half of the question, which is even as you jump. So I did platform at TalkBox. I did marketing apps at Hearsay. I had a company that was a essentially a coffee tech infrastructure company that I was a founder of. And there, a lot of the technology was in Haskell, but the user interface was a mobile app. And so as I've jumped across all these different spots, what's been common throughout is that as long as you have a way to build the artifacts that your partners can consume, that's roadmaps, that's product strategies, that's dashboards to understand what success looks like, as long as you can translate what artifacts you've built in the past to the vocabulary of the new industry that you've come to, actually product management is an infinitely transferable skill. But really in your first 30 or 60 days in any new role, the key thing is to understand the language of where you've come to and be able to inherit and use that language properly, and not ask your team, not ask that, you know, existing entity to learn your language, because there's probably a lot more reason they speak a certain way or they work a certain way. And it's better for you to build on that as opposed to trying to bring them into what you may have done somewhere else.
Great. Because there are a lot of Turkish engineers across the globe that I also meet. And I really would love for them to hear how possible it's for them to build a career in product management, what they should look for, etc. One thing you said is really critical. Yes, you do not need computer engineering degree to become a product manager or do a career in product management. This is much more convenient in the US, where you do their boot camps, their, you know, certificates that you get, etc. And it's the culture enables it. The companies are flexible to have people from various other backgrounds. Now it's changing in Turkey and Europe as well, but it's yeah. Not in the speed or flexibility the US market, I think, offers, but it's changing. So that's why people from other engineering backgrounds or even social sciences can become product managers. Any other crucial traits you think are important for them to consider, or maybe other resources that you find helpful for them to benefit?
No, that's a great question. I think there are three things that you have to have no matter what. The first one is an absolute obsession with who your customer is. You have to know who they are. And I'm not saying like build a persona and know how many cups of coffee that they drink per day. But I am saying that if you can't clearly describe to your partners, your engineering partners, your design partners, your business partners, who the customer is, the jobs that they're doing, and the task that you are trying to make easier for them to accomplish, then there's no way that, you know, you will ever be able to kind of create a product vision, because it's very easy to have ideas. In fact, everyone will have ideas. The real skill of a product manager, as far as customer obsession goes, is understanding the product ideas that are most impactful in the workflows and in the day of that specific customer. So really being able to zoom in, understanding the customer, going on interviews, you know, even if you're an engineer and you find yourself kind of coding a lot, ask the research team if there is one, ask the designers and the PMs if they're there, can you join them for customer interviews? And maybe you don't say anything the first two or three, but as you start seeing your own patterns, and that gets us to the second one, as you see your own patterns, as you can start to pattern match what people are asking for, what are they trying to do, what's hard about it, start asking your own questions. And that curiosity, that kind of intellectual curiosity, really helps carry you through from I am building a thing to I know I'm building the right thing, and getting to a place where you're convinced and your partners and your team is convinced that you're building the right thing is really that moment where you switch from being kind of someone who is customer curious to someone who can really bring the needs of the customer into the business. So I said three things, I kind of blended them all together. The first one is be customer obsessed. The second one is just look for patterns everywhere and then find ways to validate those patterns. And then the third one is just bring a intellectual curiosity to however you bring that pattern, bring that customer into the business. Don't get attached to ideas. Don't get attached to specific solutions. Instead, the more you are able to represent patterns and customers as a problem space, and then allow others to kind of fill in the solution space, the more successful you and your team are going to be, and the more likely you're able to transition into being a successful product manager.
Thank you. Talking about product management, building a career in product, maybe we can also talk more about Stripe and what you do at Stripe, how, you know, maybe the product and what you enjoy the most being at Stripe.
Absolutely. So I'm very lucky that I was able to kind of dive into a team in a moment where we had two or three really, really big problems that we needed to go solve. And I just got to grab a really big problem and run with it. I mean, I've always done startups. For me, coming to Stripe solves two problems. I wanted to learn from a wider set of product managers than I had at the small companies I worked at. And then two, I wanted to be able to take a problem and kind of shape it over a 2 to 5 year timeline. Everyone who's in startups knows that you can build a roadmap. It can be for 3 months, 6 months, a year, but you're going to get insights faster than you can actually keep that roadmap, you know, in one shape. That roadmap slide on your deck is constantly changing. So I just wanted the experience of something that didn't change as often. And so where I dove in specifically within Stripe Billing is how can Stripe Billing become a no-code property as opposed to a implementation integration first property, which, you know, Stripe has fantastic APIs, our developer advocates, our documentation team, the engineers who are building those APIs on the payments level are spectacular at what they do. But it turns out, and this is where the customer obsession comes in, it turns out that whether you're a startup founder or you're the head of revenue operations at a Series B, Series C company, you really only want to integrate, you really only want to invest engineering time after you're certain that something is, you know, going to stick around for a while. So at that startup stage, at that experimentation stage, at that growth stage, having lots of no-code tools that allow you to play with pricing, that allow you to play with customer churn mitigation, that allow you to kind of deflect involuntary churn, end up being really valuable because you don't actually want to spend a lot of time building it until you know it works. And that's where I've been really lucky to build those surfaces. Specifically, I own the Stripe customer portal. We make it so that customer management can happen in a no-code way. My partner is working on the subscriptions editor and how can we make running a sales-led business within Stripe billing really easy to do straight from the dashboard. Again, trying to minimize the integration time, the engineering investment you have to make. We're really committed to understanding how in a no-code way we can make recurring revenue, you know, as simple as a Wix or a Squarespace make building a website. Like, that's the level of simplicity we need to get to. And that's the vision of where we're trying to get Stripe billing to.
Another question I'm curious about is when we talk about culture, you coming from a Turkish family and then becoming a part of an international team, how do you think that played out throughout your career? How that was an advantage and maybe a disadvantage at times?
Yeah, you know, honestly, as a kid in America, in the American South, kind of in and around 9/11, being not from the South was a very complex issue. When you're Turkish, you can kind of blend in, but everyone knows you're not Christian. When you're kind of in the Turkish community and you're very proud of it, you have this very kind of like strong kind of North Carolina, strong kind of military presence there, a lot of kind of American nationalism as well. So as a kid, I think it taught me a lot of empathy. And it forced a lot of empathy, and it forced a lot of kind of being able to see the world from other people's eyes, which bluntly as a product manager is such a critical skill, you know, that empathy piece. There were moments where it was really hard. You know, there were moments where you really felt like you didn't belong. But, you know, there are a lot of moments where you got to bring a perspective or you got to bring an experience into people's lives that was unique. And that part of it, I loved. I loved sharing the food that my mom would make. You know, I loved, you know, bringing back Nazar Boncuks for friends and then having them wear it at school. And they were so proud that they got a present from Turkey. And, you know, and I know that those are like, you know, 10 cent things that you can pick up at any like, you know, farmer's market. But for them, it was something from a whole different world. It was an experience. It was a way of showing this multicultural world that they were a part of as well. So those pieces I absolutely loved. I found in my professional life, kind of being in between both worlds, there's something about not being Turkish enough to kind of join Turkish communities, but then not always finding your place in kind of native communities as well. And so, you know, in finding that middle ground, I've tended towards having friendships with people who are either immigrants or first generation like myself. I find that my friendships are with entrepreneurs or people who are in technology, because both of those communities can realize my lived experience and support me in it in a way that's just not the same if, you know, you were born and raised in Raleigh and you're the fifth generation of your family who lived there. So for me, I think net, I'm incredibly happy that I was born here. I'm incredibly proud of kind of that mix of Turkish and American experience that I've had. What I'm most happy about is that I allowed it to make me resilient instead of allowing it to kind of defeat me.
Thank you very much for the genuine conversation, Mili. I hope to see you soon.
No, I loved it. Thank you so much for having me. And, you know, if anybody wants to reach out to me, you can find me on LinkedIn or on Twitter, Mili Önvural on LinkedIn and M. Önvural on Twitter. Please, like, feel free to ask any questions, and I would, you know, love to connect.
Great. That's great to have. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.